Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, aka Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today I'm speaking with Nick Bostrom. He's a philosopher doing research at Yale, and he's the co-founder of the World Transhumanist Association. Well, I'm really glad to have you with me today, Nick. You just recently came over from living in England. How long were you in England?
I was there 4.5 years in London.
Uh-huh. And before we get into some of your philosophical issues, I wanted to just to touch on the fact that you're an extremely well-rounded person for my fantasy of a philosopher. Being a sociologist, I haven't rubbed too many elbows with philosophers. But on your CV, you have, in fact, run a radio show. You ran one in London, was it?
Yes.
And what was that about?
We discussed a variety of transhumanist-related topics, such as cryonics, the freezing of the dead, in the hope that future technology will be able to reanimate them, smart drugs, philosophical ideas related to transhumanism, and so on.
And you've been a stand-up comic?
I did a bit of that, too, in my youth, yes.
And a playwright and an actor?
A little bit of that, yes.
What was your play about?
It's quite esoteric, actually. It probably doesn't make any sense unless you were a student or staff at the Stockholm School of Physics, which was where it was performed. It was about how there is a Swedish company called Ericsson that makes these mobile phones, which is Sweden's biggest company, I think, and they're kind of sucking up all the talent from the physics school. So it was about the temptations of free holidays in Bermuda and other advantages versus the austere path that could eventually lead to a Nobel Prize. So it's about how does a young physicist choose between these two alternatives?
Now, you have mixed in your career philosophy, physics, math, and computer science. Your 1996 master's thesis on Quine's indeterminacy thesis. Now, in our previous discussion, you described Quine's indeterminacy thesis as having to do with the definition of words.
He's an analytic philosopher. He's one of the most famous analytic philosophers of this century. There are not many people know of him outside academia. Although he's within that tradition, he criticizes the earlier thinking of the logical positivists who thought that there was a clear sense of analyticity, that certain statements are true just in virtue of their meanings, whereas other statements are statements about matters of fact, and that there is a sharp distinction. Quine doesn't think that there is. So it has to do with logic, analyticity, and logical implications, and also about concepts such as beliefs, and language, and thoughts.
And you did a second master's thesis then after that one on cortical integration and applying theories from information theory and computer science to that. How did you arrive at that topic?
That's in computational neuroscience. That's a really cool field. If I were not doing philosophy now, I think I would choose to be a computational neuroscientist. It's really fascinating. It's just in the past maybe 1.5 decades or so that we have begun to understand how the brain works. How does this lump of gray matter inside our skull, how does that perform the computations that enable us to communicate like we are doing right now, or to walk, or to choose careers? How does that lump of neurons support the computations that make us what we are, essentially humans? And in the past 1.5 decades, we have begun to strike on a paradigm that enables us to begin to address those questions. We can run computer simulations of small neural networks. We can see how the whole thing is hooked up. We're still just at the early beginning, but it's a field where new discoveries are happening all the time.
Again, I'm speaking with Nick Bostrom. He's a Swedish philosopher, recent graduate of the London School of Economics, recently doctored, and now working on a research grant and research at Yale down in New Haven. And your PhD at London School of Economics, what was that on?
In that PhD, I was developing the first mathematically explicit theory of observational selection effects. Now, that has to do with how do you evaluate the evidential bearing of evidence on some hypothesis when you know that that evidence that you have has been filtered through some kind of observational selection effects. And it's relevant in a number of fields, for example, cosmology and evolutionary biology. If you're asking, say, a question like how improbable was it that intelligent life should evolve on a planet like Earth? Now, some people might think that, okay, we have looked at one planet like Earth and intelligent life evolved there, so probably it's not that unlikely for intelligent life to evolve. But just a moment's reflection, of course, shows that an observational selection effect is in work here. It's not an accident that the planet we have looked at was one where life evolved. We didn't sample a random planet and see if life evolved there, but obviously we just observed one of those planets where, as it happened, intelligent life evolved. So you come to a conclusion in that case. And there are much more subtle, similar effects in cosmology and in evolutionary biology, and also in fields like traffic planning and in a number of thought experiments and in game theoretic problems involving imperfect recall. And I think there is a kind of unifying principle behind all these different applications that I was researching.
The anthropic principle?
It's related to that, yeah. And there's it's dangerous to use that word because there are so many different things that have been called the anthropic principle, some of which are trivial and true, some of which are crazy and false, and some of which are too vague to make any sense. But then inside this cluster, there is one that's really interesting, I think, yes.
There may not be very many rival definitions since you now own the domain name anthropic-principle.com and you have your website up there, one of your many websites.
Yeah.
And related to that, apparently, is the doomsday. Can you give us, in a nutshell, what the doomsday hypothesis is?
The doomsday argument, it's a purported application of one of these anthropic principles, trying to show that we have systematically underestimated the probability that humankind will go extinct in the relatively near future. And most people, when you explain this argument, think there must be something wrong with it, because it uses very few and weak empirical premises. So it's surprising how could you possibly get such a conclusion from such weak premises. So people have tried to find what is wrong with it, but there is no consensus as to what the flaw is. All attempted refutations so far have failed. Or at least I think that was the case until quite recently. Now I have some ideas of how it's possible to avoid this conclusion. But I think you have to, if you regard this as a problem, it can only be solved within the context of a general theory of observational selection effects.
Mm-hmm. So again, if folks are interested in, more in the doomsday argument and anthropic principle, they can go to anthropic-principle.com where you have all of that laid out. And I'm speaking with Nick Bostrom, who's a Swedish philosopher and also the co-founder of the World Transhumanist Association. Now, what is transhumanism?
Transhumanism is the philosophy that we can use technologies to extend our human capabilities. For example, extend lifespan or increasing our intellectual, physical, and emotional capacities. So transhumanism, you could distinguish between two senses. In one sense, it's the study of these present and anticipated future technologies that will enable us to do this, as well as their potential dangers and their possible benefits. In the other sense, you add a value component so that transhumanists actually want to do this. They want to become, in some sense, more than human.
Mm-hmm. Now, the World Transhumanist Association grew out of a pre-existing set of transhumanist ideas that had developed around the Extropy Institute and Max Moore and other people who founded that. What were the initial inspirations for starting this separate World Transhumanist Association?
Well, the Extropy Institute is specifically devoted to extropianism, which is a kind of transhumanism. But there are other kinds of transhumanism as well, and we thought that there was a need for having an organization which could cover this whole area. So all extropians would be transhumanists, but not necessarily all transhumanists are extropians.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that would distinguish most extropians from most non-extropian world transhumanists would be the extropians' rather dogmatic brand of anarcho-capitalism?
Well, I think in the recent version of their extropian principles, they don't state adherence to anarcho-capitalism as a condition for being extropian. I think one difference is that extropianism is defined by the extropian principle, which is authored by Max Moore. So whatever that document says, that's what extropianism is. Transhumanism is a word that nobody owns,
mm-hmm.
so nobody can choose what it means, and that's also a strength, because I think it creates more opportunities for people to develop their own theories and thinking
mm-hmm.
by having such an open-ended term. And another factor also, I should say, for why the WTA was founded is that we try to especially encourage academic research into transhumanist-related fields.
Mm-hmm. You sort of founded the Journal of Transhumanism.
Yeah, that's one of the things we do. That's a scholarly, peer-reviewed online journal which tries to publish papers, good papers on transhumanist-related stuff.
And that's at transhumanism.org.
Yes.
And transhumanism.com is the set of documents that were written by the early World Transhumanist Association fellows, the FAC that you wrote, and also the principles.
Yeah. And those two documents are part of an attempt to begin to develop a sort of shared set of assumptions and articulate what makes us transhumanist.
Now, one of the things that strikes me about the FAC and the principles, which I've given a pretty careful study, is the way in which they differ from the extropian principles. One is that they explicitly talk about the risks of technology
mm-hmm.
and our need to have proactive public policies, in particular things like gray goo, the nanotechnology out-of-control scenarios,
mm-hmm.
and the need to have proactive public policies. And both in that document and in your own writing have discussed the need perhaps to extend global governance to address these kinds of global threats.
Now, the risk, that's very essential. I see that as half, no less than half of transhumanism. Half should be about the benefits, potential gains that new technologies can give. And just as important are the potential risks, which with some of these technologies are enormous. Not perhaps so much the gray goo scenario, which is the accidental mishaps using nanotechnology, nanoreplicators, run amok by some mistake or error. People who are studying these things are more concerned nowadays about, you could call it black, or the deliberate abuse of nanotechnology. Nanotechnology would be an extremely powerful technology, and as such, it could be used for both good and bad ends. In particular, it could have military usages, which could be horrendous. So there's a lot of concern about minimize the risk.
And in fact, the U.S. government is pouring $500 million into nanotechnology, mostly through the Department of Defense.
Yes. So I see that as an extremely important part of transhumanism, to try to get a realistic picture of what the threats are and to develop pragmatic ways of countering them. Because it's crucial here not to say that technology in general is dangerous or bad, because that kind of diffuses the threat picture. It's essential to distinguish between the technologies that are really dangerous from the ones that just appear to be dangerous, such as
mm-hmm.
cloning, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard a realistic threat scenario stemming from cloning or
right.
genetically modified food. Okay, we have to test it, but I don't really think it's that dangerous. But then something like molecular nanotechnology, which could endanger the existence of intelligent life. It's of a totally different category altogether. And it's crucial, I think, to make it clear that these things are separate and to distinguish between them.
Now, another thing that seems to distinguish the World Transhumanist documents, there were 30 co-authors, so I don't know if it's possible to distinguish individual contributions, but there is a very clear statement of the continuity of transhumanism with pre-existing humanist and liberal democratic ideas,
mm-hmm.
whereas Max Moore has attempted to draw more of a discontinuity with those ideas and more of a continuity with, for instance, Nietzsche or some other philosophical strains. And so do you see that as one of the goals of world transhumanism, is to talk about the parameters? You know, you say you want 1,000 flowers to bloom for different kinds of transhumanism, but you and I were recently involved online with the issue of whether a Nazi group who considered themselves transhumanists, belonged in any of these circles. And, where do you come down on that?
Well, I think Nazi transhumanism is a contradiction. You could call it trans-Nazism, whatever. It's not humanism. Nazism is not humanism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can tell you the way I see the connection with classical humanism. I think it's essential. I think, okay, so let's set aside all logic coupling and niceties, and I think there are two core ideas to transhumanism. One is the trans part, which is that technologies will be developed in the relatively near future that will totally revolutionize the world one way or another. Talking about nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, genetic engineering, virtual reality, mood drugs, etc., etc. So there are these huge factors that will change the world. That's the transport, the realization, and the attempt to understand those. And then there is the humanism part, which is, okay, given that all these difficult choices will have to be made, all these new things will come around, how do we approach it? How can we guide our actions today as to maximize the likelihood that the world will turn out nice? And you have to have some kind of values to guide your actions. And I think that classical humanism, the humanist tradition, provides a great set of such values. They place emphasis on things like respect for human beings, that we can achieve happiness in this world, that we should accept differences among humans, that each human being has a great potential that they can seek to realize, that we should develop rounded characters that can appreciate different aspects of life, that we should use rationality and critical thinking, and so on. I think if I were to appoint some person who had to make all these difficult choices about whether to develop nanotechnology and how to regulate the world where there are artificial intelligences and uploads, I wouldn't choose somebody who had some kind of extremist ideology or were a religious fundamentalist or a deep green or something like that. Mm-hmm. I would rather choose somebody who had an appreciation of the great distance that human society and human culture has traveled from our ancient past, and had a respect and love for their fellow human beings. And that's, for me, what humanism is about.
One of the strains of transhumanism that I was influenced by was Bruce Sterling's Schismatrix novels, where he uses that phrase. And his explicit use of it is for an ideology that attempts to hold together the subspeciation to come of humanity and post-humanity, that attempts to create the political context, the identities, the political citizenship concepts that would keep people who are radically different from one another, some incredibly smarter, some incredibly more powerful than others, together in one polity. Do you see that as a part of that?
Well, that's obviously a big issue. How do you, already today, it's kind of difficult for society to hold together when there are so many different groups and classes and sects and cultures. And there are some standardizing measures, like everybody has to learn certain things in school, that we try to do to keep society together. Now, if the native abilities of people not only vary within the parameters they do today, but if, say, future technologies increase those differences, then that problem will become even bigger. And that's certainly something that transhumanists are thinking about, and it's going to be a big controversial topic in the future, I'm sure.
You completed your studies in Sweden. By the way, I'm talking with Nick Bostrom. I guess it's not fair to say that you're a Swedish philosopher. I mean, I'm sure that you consider yourself a cosmopolitan at this point.
Yeah.
But you do originate from Sweden. Are you a refugee, by the way, from Swedish social democracy? You completed your studies in a great haste and took a lot of different things at one time. And one of the things that you've said in interviews about that is that you felt the weight of Swedish egalitarianism pressing down on you, and you needed to make a stand against that by standing out from the pack. Do you feel that's why you migrated to the United States to experience our great effervescence of freedom and liberty over here?
Well, I don't know. If you are young and you want to do things in the world, you want to achieve and explore things, it's natural, I think, to check out more than one place. I was living in London for 4.5 years, and I had great fun there. That was a good part of my life. And even at an earlier stage, when I was still in Sweden, I did other things there. I was kind of passionate about poetry, and I painted and had art exhibitions and stuff like that. So I suppose if I'm called up on the Day of Judgment by kind of questioned by some existentialist like Albert Camus or something, I can always point to those segments of my life and say, look, I've lived, I've done that. So even if I spend the rest of my time digging out footnotes in the library or something, I kind of still have my insurance regarding the having had a life bit.
So your attitude towards Swedish social democracy, do you think that that's a political form that may or may not survive in the future?
That's a difficult one. It's a kind of peculiar. I don't all knock Sweden. It has some great advantages too. It's a society where you are, especially if you're weak or vulnerable, you are more taken care of than you are in England or here in the States. I mean, compared to most of the world, any rich country is highly privileged. Most of people live in countries where they barely have enough to eat, so we're all very lucky in that respect.
Do you see the transcending of national boundaries? One of the things, I come from a social democratic socialist political background, and one of the things that has become very clear to me over the last 20 years is that the Sweden's, Jamaica's, even France's can't institute advanced welfare states so long as they live in a world that is reliant on investment capital, that has capital mobility, and capital will always flow to places, generally will flow to places that don't impose the kind of burdens that Swedish social democracy would impose. And one of the things you've written about is the globalization of public policy. You haven't, so far as I've seen, talked about global governance explicitly. But do you foresee, there is an argument out there, for instance, the non-zero, there's a book out called The Non-Zero Equation or something, that argues that the natural course of human evolution is to transcend the nation state and create global governance. Do you think that that is a plausible outcome?
It looks natural. We began as some kind of tribes on the African savanna, and then small villages with some kind of kingpin sitting there, and then city-states, and now we have nation-states and kind of intergovernmental organizations and the European Union. It's possible to discern a trend towards the breakdown of geographical locality, at least. Now, if that results in a world government or just in a series of overlapping global organizations, I suppose is perhaps partly an open question. Mm-hmm. But I do think that geographic locality is going to become less important, especially when good virtual reality comes around in a decade and a half, when you can actually telework, you can be at your office and interact socially with your office mates, just as if you were there, even if you are perhaps on a different continent. I think that's going to really be the nail in the coffin for a lot of philosophies which emphasize that it's important where you happen to be born, nationalism, etc., which are quite stupid to begin with, but are going to be obviously stupid when that happens, I hope at least.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, asking you and other transhumanists to make predictions about the future is a complicated endeavor because of the theory of the singularity, which is a rapid and discontinuous set of changes, the convergence of a number of technologies at some point in the next 30 to 50 years. And it's kind of a secular version of a religious millenarian thinking, which says, we can talk about, keeping our act together for the next 30 years, but who knows, once the singularity comes, all bets are off, everything's up for grabs. Mm-hmm. Now, is that your version of the singularity, or do you have a more... some versions of the singularity are just that we can't predict, that there's a certain amount of unknowability.
Yeah, that's different. There are different concepts that are kind of mingled together. One is the unpredictability, a point at which we can't predict any further. And then there is another definition which says that it's a point where technological progress becomes very rapid. The third definition is that it's a point where we create superhuman intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might speculate that these things could co-incur, that they happen at the same time. We create superhuman artificial intelligence, and that causes technological progress to speed up enormously because the super intelligence would be much better at inventing new technologies than we humans are, and because things change so rapidly, we can't predict what happens beyond it. But these are three separate claims, and I certainly think that you could speculate and theorize about different possible scenarios through the singularity and beyond. And I would also object, I think, to the drawing an analogy with kind of religious end of the millennium cults. And
the analogy is not new to me. There's actually a very funny short story out there about extropians and what they don't do about their lives because they expect the singularity to come right around the corner. I fall prey to this myself. I mean, when my kids, I have two children, and when they ask me things like, "Daddy, are there unicorns?" I say, "Well, not yet, but you know, maybe in 20 years." You know, Daddy, can I get married to more than one person? Well, you know, in a couple of years, yeah, I think so, because I'm deeply influenced by this notion that there's going to be rapid, discontinuous change around the corner.
No, I think that the difference that I'm want to stress is that it's kind of a technological extrapolation. Nobody knows for certain that there will be a singularity, and most people just see it as a hypothesis, although a fairly likely one. If you extrapolate the growth of computing power, if you think about what might happen when computers get as smart as humans and then a little smarter and they design the next generation of computers, it's the reasoning behind it, I think, that that makes it something different altogether from some kind of religious dogma. It just seems a fairly plausible way in which the future could unfold.
There are a number of organizations, clubs around the world and around the United States, New York City, Boston, California, often overlapping with the extropians. Is it the goal of the WTA to create more of those kinds of clubs?
The WTA acts mostly as an umbrella organization. So a lot of the actual day-to-day activity is done by local groups. And there are such groups. There are several very active ones in Europe and here in the States, and many more are wanting to start groups. We have a page also at the World Transhumanist Association website where different people in different parts of the world say that, hey, I want to get together with other transhumanists in the Philippines or in, say, Chicago, wherever they might be living. And the idea then is that people who visit the site might then choose to get in touch with these people, and if there are enough people in one place, they might just start up their own little thing there.
I really want to thank you for joining us today, Nick. I've been talking with Nick Bostrom. He's a philosopher, a cosmopolitan philosopher, originally from Sweden, recent graduate of the London School of Economics, working at Yale, co-founder of the World Transhumanist Association, and you can find out more about Nick at nickbostrom.com, and they can email you at nick.bostrom@yale.edu. Is that correct?
Nick@nickbostrom.com nick.bostrom@yale.edu.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Previous Change Surfer radio programs can be listened to from www.changesurfer.com and streaming MP3, thanks to the Radio for All project.